Testing, 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 testing. See if this piece of machinery is going to work or if it's going to behave the way that some others have behaved in my life. Most machinery defeats me. This is March 8th in the year 2000, and I'm Calder Pickett. This is going to be an interview with Samuel Adams. One of my longtime colleagues in the School of Journalism and a friend ever since he came here back in the 1970s. I have conducted other interviews with people in the School of Journalism, but this will be I interviewed Dana about a year ago, I guess. But actually, most of the interviews I've done have been with other people in other schools and departments. Sam, I want to start with some kind of basic stuff about you. I'd like you to tell us first your date of birth, your place of birth, and then the names of your parents, and what your father did, what his work was, and so on, to get us started. Okay?
I was born January 25th. 1926 in Waycross, Georgia. I was the third of six children born to Viola and J.N. Adams. J.N.'s real name was Joe Nathan Adams, but there was another Joe that was Joe David, so he was always called J.N. He was the youngest of the four kids that I knew. Mm-hmm. He had a sister who was just above him and two brothers who lived there. But there was another brother who was born earlier and lived in the north whom I didn't know. Jan Adams was really the son of slave parents, parents who were born before the end of slavery. He was a very enterprising and hardworking person whose education was in a one-room schoolhouse in Tattnall County, Georgia. My mother was married to him at age 16. She had gone as far as she was allowed to go in school in Waycross, Georgia, so the next thing was to get married, and she was also in a one-parent family.
You know, Sam, most of the people I've talked with, their parents did not have a whole lot of education, and they did not, and many of them went to one-room schools.
That's interesting, but in his case, the one-room schooling was 4 years, yet he was really brilliant. His knowledge was superior to mine in a lot of areas.
Yeah.
I always remember that he could crunch numbers without the benefit of computers and or calculators.
What did he do for a living?
A variety of jobs. He decided earlier that he would work for himself. He started as a shoemaker, and he taught me to be a shoe cobbler. But in that time, we would fix umbrellas, I'd fix irons, do loads of things with one's hands, and he insisted that each of us work each day. Though we would sometimes I would go in early in the morning before school to put in an hour of work so that I might be away in the evening to play football or some other things like that.
Now, this was something that he did at home then.
No, in the hometown. But my dad started his business jointly with one brother, and then he moved his shop downtown next to City Hall. And part of my early racial memories relate to that because there was a desire for him not to be where he was, and it led to changes in his life and in his business, because as the lease was moved from under him, from his business next to City Hall and police station nearby, right downtown, he moved a block up next door to a jeweler whose name I'll always remember. But the jeweler, who himself was leasing, disliked having someone of color with a business next to his, and we had to move. He only was able to stay there a month.
Oh, boy.
And so he decided, I will own my own building. I will do other different things. And so he moved his business closer to home into another district. And then finally, he was able to build his own building. His building was a shoe repairing, and business changed because rather than simply serving the elite whites from downtown, his business needed to do other things now. So he would repair old boots and stuff that came out of surplus from the war, and sell. There was a bargain store, and all of those things that were there. And then when we were all in school, sometimes later, my mother set up her business. It became a dry cleaning business, and a mother who was a presso worked for her. And so those buildings were on the same lot near my home.
How big a town was Waycross?
Waycross, now I guess it's about 50,000, maybe less than that, but somewhere around that. But then it was about 15,000, I think.
Now I don't know Georgia. I of course have driven through, and I've been in Atlanta, places like that. Where is Waycross?
Waycross is the county seat for the Okefenokee Swamp.
Down south then.
Oh yes, we're talking about 70 miles from Jacksonville, Florida. Maybe less than 70 miles from Jacksonville. It's inland from Brunswick, about 50 miles between Brunswick, midway between Brunswick and Valdosta, going east to west. So it is inland and is the county seat for that land of trembling earth. It's where the cartoon Pogo is.
Okay. Yeah. Sam, I'll probably be asking you some dumb questions, but they're the kinds of things that I think we all want to talk about. I am assuming that that this was a highly segregated town.
It was, but that's not a dumb question. And yes, you know the answer. It was very highly segregated. As a matter of fact, even though I lived close to where I could get sewer, wasn't allowed. The man who picked up the dung then came through an alley nearby. We used a pump early on. Things are very different now, but all of it had a lot to do, I think, with how my dad performed. He was one of the original organizers 80 years ago of the NAACP down there. He was a founding organizer of Keystone Voters League, and there were loads of people there who understood the need for change, and they were positive in their approaches to how to bring it about, and the political changes there now are just great.
How conscious were you as a little boy of the matter of segregation? I imagine that you went to a school that was all black children. You didn't, or did you?
Went to a school of all black children, but when I was downtown at my dad's business, there was a central school, Central High, I believe it was, there, and there was a playground, and I could go to the playground and play. And the interactions, you know, between young blacks and whites was not unusual. The South was noted for backyard segregation, and as long as people were young and prior to puberty, you might play together, though you might also encounter some horrible things. When the school was overcrowded in my elementary school, fifth grade, I had to walk across town, walk past the white schools into another district for schools, and sometimes fights would break out just because whites would want you to get off of the sidewalk to let them pass, or some other kinds of insults, which young persons like myself resisted and, well, did not really tolerate well.
Yeah. You know, this is something that it's kind of, I won't say it's hard to comprehend because I know a lot about it in a historical sense. But, you know, there was nothing like this in my life. There was nothing. See, this is the difference. This is the difference when it comes to the races. I've never had an experience. Well, the only kind of experience that I had that would suggest something that involved bigotry. A little story I want to tell you. Nola's mother worked for a Jewish tailor in Ogden, Utah, one of the grandest men I've ever known. Well, we were in there, and I used to get clothes from him that people, it was very near the depot, and people would come in and they would sell their clothes to him. Then he would sell them to me for a very low price. That's the kind of clothes I wore for a long time after we got married. Didn't have much money, you know. And he was pressing some pants for me. And this guy, it was a one-arm guy, came in, and he was thrusting his way around in there. And he wanted to get his pants pressed. And Harry, the tailor, said, just a minute, after I get the pants pressed for this gentleman. And he says, "Why, you goddamn Jew kikes," all of us. we were all Jew kikes to him.
Yeah.
And Nola's mother, who was used to people like him, reached under the counter, and she had a blackjack. Uh-huh. And where she got, I don't know, but she went after him and uh-huh. chased him out of that place. But I had the feeling then, I understood briefly what Jewish people would have to go through sometimes. So, you know, I'm really appreciative of these things. Did you say you had brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have three brothers and two sisters. I had three brothers. I lost a brother a year and a half ago in Atlanta.
Tell me a little bit about your home. Did you have books, magazines, newspapers, radio?
Yes. Hung to the radio like white on rice when Joe Louis was fighting or when there was something else of significance, especially as it related to racial progress. Waycross was a very progressive town, and my mother was very keen on education. She was in state PTAs and in all of those kinds of things. And she ran, when all of us were in school, she ran her own business. My sister was very bright, became a Fulbright fella, and all of those kinds of things were set, the kinds of goals that sort of permeated the family, And as a result, my family stayed in school longer than expected.
Yeah.
And so five of us were in college at once.
That's wonderful. That's really wonderful. Tell me, did the Depression hit your family much?
Yes, but who knew? Who knew about it?
Yeah, that's like us. Everybody was poor.
We were already poor. It was not a sharp change for us. But I would say it's depression because of what was going on, and I know about it historically. But how I knew about it then was not to know about it. Of course, it is why there was such a great love for the compassionate president of the time.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Yeah.
And I wouldn't call him a compassionate conservative. I'd just call him a compassionate man. But then he had a wife who was even more compassionate from the points of view of my colleagues and associates down in Georgia.
So you became quite conscious of the fact that Roosevelt was president and that we had the New Deal and these things.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And it affected politics because even though we in the South ran the Republican Party, we ran it defensively because we could not be in the Democratic primary. And so we were in all supporters of the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, until a president came out of Kansas and had followers that sort of rejected black leadership of the Republican Party, and then came the Democratic troubles and the walkout of the Democratic Party, and it led to a total shift in the orientation of Southern blacks, although they ran the Republican Party and put up Republican candidates except for president. They in the national election for president, they all were voting for Roosevelt.
Yeah. Sam, tell me about your about your grade school. Do you remember the teachers? Do you remember them by name or any way that they influenced you?
Yes, I remember them from grade school. I remember the left-handed Viola Woods because even though she was thin and whatever, she believed in a little corporate punishment, and I can see her picking up one of my classmates by the seat of his pants and a little spanking with a hand. Nothing was ever very violent or serious, but you knew that there was displeasure if you did something wrong. I remember my third grade teacher. I remember loads of those teachers, but I remember many of them because they were family friends. They were
okay. They
were part of the community. This was a little town, and so you they followed you. They had some sense of your abilities and would insist upon your achieving whatever their goals were.
What did you like in school? What were you good at?
My trouble was that I was a jack of too many trades. I loved loads of things. I loved the arts. I loved music. I loved writing. Yet I also loved doing things with my hands. And I did them all. It's partially why I ended up in journalism, because my teachers then said, okay, it's okay for you to go into something that blacks can't survive in.
Yeah.
You will survive. You will do okay because there's a variety of things you can do.
I asked my grandson, who's a very good student, what his favorite class was. Recess. which I'm sure is something that lots of the children would say.
I think of the great recess we had on the first snow I saw in Waycross. I was in elementary school.
Oh, really?
They let us out. I think it was on my birthday, January 25th, and it was, I must have been maybe second grade or whatever, but they let us out to run and play in it.
Sam, did you ever have to get out when you were a little boy and have a job, work yourself, to earn money?
Not to earn money. Had to get out and earn and get a job, but the job was in the family. My family was protective, and they would not allow us to work for whites at that time to avoid some of the abuse that some of the neighbor kids would encounter. But we worked more than anyone else because we were working in the family business. Even though my family said one shouldn't work on Sunday, we found ourselves dry cleaning business, making deliveries after midnight.
Yeah.
And it always bothered me because I said, hey, that's Sunday. But they didn't want people coming for their clothes on Sunday, and so we needed to finish our work. So we worked all the time.
How about play? Were you able to get out into the countryside around Waycross? And was there a river there or anything that you... What could you go swimming, or did you go fishing or anything like that?
I never went fishing. Don't like to fish today. My dad loves it. And I didn't know that he loved fishing so much until later in life, when he is now able to do it, because he worked from sun up to sunset all the time. And I learned later he fished.
It was just like my dad. He didn't fish until he retired.
Boy. And it seemed that my dad, he went so long before he retired. He was in the 90s before he was doing things, but he set a day, there was a day off, and after we all had left, there was always that Wednesday fishing on his day off, and he had friends there to take him crabbing or fishing. Well, he was a seaport town person, so I can understand his love of fishing, but as for other members of the family, none of us are tuned into fishing.
When you got into high school, junior high and high school, did you go into sports?
Yes, with a bang. But in order to accommodate sports, I would go to work with my dad in the morning before school, so that I would be able to get the time off to practice football or whatever. I was small, so... And
were you any good?
Oh, I was super good.
Oh, were you?
Yes. Got a lot of ink, and partly because even after I got to college, played college football too, wanting to do it, I remember a young lady telling me, okay, I walked like I was stepping in hot spit. She said something different. But it was that my gait was not as, let's say, manly as she might have wanted to be. And this kind of challenges to one masculinity, I think, had some impact on my choosing football, but I liked athletics anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I played football, was good at that, was not as good at basketball. My brother was a super baseball player, left-handed. Oh, he could hit and throw. He's this brother that's deceased now. But in football, I was Oh, the PT garden. It was so fast that I was able to do things with bigger people than most. And in college, I suffered a little a chromocullar separation and some physical things because I was playing football with huge people, and you know, I didn't take a back seat for anyone.
When did you graduate from high school? 44?
No. Yes, 44.
See, well, you're the same age as my brother. He was born in 26, and I know well that he got out in 44. And then did World War II catch you?
Yes, except that I was not taken into World War II. I went into the services after college. I went into the Korean conflict when many of my colleagues went in and became first lieutenants, and so many of them got killed. But some of them also became the first line of black generals. I was at West Virginia State College, and that ROTC program produced a lot of great soldiers.
I was interested. How come you went clear up West Virginia to school?
It's interesting how I went to any schools. My parents would support any school I chose. I was looking for a good school, and there were, of course, schools in Atlanta. The girls went to Atlanta. They went to Morris Brown College, the church school. Both of the girls went to the same place. The boys, the oldest boy went to Tuskegee, and then to the army. Then he came back to Tuskegee. The boy who was next to me, he and I finished college at the same time. He went to Fisk, private, and a little more expensive than state schools. I chose West Virginia, and we were allowed to go wherever we wanted to go.
West Virginia State College.
Yes.
Well, now, were your parents able to send you up there? See, you weren't able to come home weekends or anything like that.
No, but the boys didn't get their monies that often. We had to work. I went to West Virginia, and a Georgian was president. John W. Davis was president, who grew up. He would always say that he grew up in Milledgeville, Georgia, and he escaped all of the institutions there: Milledgeville State Penitentiary, also the Reidsville State Penitentiary is there, and then there was the insane asylum, etc. But John W. Davis took a liking to me, and I survived well at West Virginia State. The tuition wasn't always there, but I was able to work in his house and do other things.
Well, now, was that a black
Yes.
school?
Yes. It's no longer black. As soon as the 54 decision came about, West Virginia State was taken over by white students. It suddenly changed from 100% black to 60-40, no, 80-20. 80-20 as whites streamed into the school. But they streamed in from the city. They didn't move on campus, and that was the difference. But it was the example, the 54 decision. I wrote about it and visited there. The 54 decision, you see, gave liberty to whites in that general vicinity.
Well, now, where is it? What?
It's near Charleston, West Virginia.
Okay.
Whites had the school at Marshall, at Huntington, which was away from the capital. Marshall was not the good school that West Virginia State was, I
Did
think.
you live in a dorm or in a
Yes.
okay.
We lived in
All
dorms.
of the, all now you went for 4 straight years
Yes.
and graduated then in 48.
Yes.
Is that where you went into journalism?
I started journalism, but they didn't have a real program there. They had there was a Harvard-trained drama professor who had also had some journalism. He taught the journalism classes, and we ran the newspapers under him. And I was, you know, running the newspapers and boasting that, okay, the other football players, they had their little popularity during during the football season and basketball season, but I had things of interest to do year-round because I would shift into to journalism and was, you know, an editor of the newspaper and yearbook, that sort of thing.
Now, you said earlier that that the armed forces finally got you. Was that after then?
After that. See, in 1958, I graduated. But
now, 48.
1948.
Yeah.
In 1948, I graduated. And the Korean War was yeah. to start soon afterwards. When I graduated in 48, I went to Detroit. Having sung in the choir and visited Detroit, ran into a family that liked me, and it sort of helped attract me to Detroit. And I went there, found a cousin to stay with, and I worked nights. I went to work. I got a job in the factory to go to work at 11:20 p.m. I got off at 8. Thanks to the cousin, I got this job, and I was able to get a night shift. And at 8, I got off at 7:20. At 8 in the morning, I would go to school at Wayne State. So
Wayne State, that's in Detroit. Yeah.
That was in Detroit. It was Wayne University then, because the state, it was a municipal university. The state took it over later. And so I graduated from Wayne at about the time that they were pulling me into the Korean War.
And yeah, you got two different bachelor's degrees.
Sure.
The way I read it.
Sure.
You got one in West Virginia, and then you got a second one?
Sure.
At Wayne State.
Yes.
And then Korea came.
Yes. And I went to Wisconsin, Camp McCoy, for training. Eventually became a chemical, biological, radiological specialist there, and also,
my Lord,
was the Army way and the Army training. I joined a National Guard unit and was about to be shipped to Korea, and because of I worked in the service unit. I worked there with a lady from Washington State. I'll never forget her, Miss Lewis. She was the girlfriend of the colonel, and she liked fishing. She would take me away before I finished basic. She accompany her to La Crosse. There's the river there, and she would fish. And I was just there for more or less the company. But as they were about to ship me overseas, she knew about it and sort of, I think, intervened with the colonel. I was of great use in the USO. I'd paint their signs. I did all kinds of things of use to them. And gosh, I didn't go. I stayed with that National Guard unit, which was a tight unit. They protected one another. They had youngsters from Boston area. The colonel and all the officers were there. And there was a cadre for training others. So they then kept me long enough till when they were sent overseas, they were sent to Germany. And in that way, I missed Vietnam. Something to feel guilty about, because had I stayed in the ROTC, I would not have missed Vietnam. My friends who were into ROTC were called quickly to go to Korea. They were officers, second lieutenants, and so many were mowed down as a result.
Well, nothing to feel guilty about. When did you meet Eleanor?
I met Eleanor after I returned from the services. That was 1953.
Okay,
52.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where was that you met her? What was her background?
She was working for the Atlanta Life Insurance Company. She had been parentless from age two. Her mother died in childbirth with her younger sister, and the dad died soon after, but the family always kept together. A pretty large family, but sisters and aunts kept them together. And she had started at Spelman, went to Los Angeles City College, and with a relative, came back and did her college work at Spelman. But she was then working for the Atlanta Life Insurance Company, a black insurance company, when I met her.
So
and I had returned. I returned to Waycross, not to Waycross, to Atlanta, to do to begin a journalism career, and she was there, and she sent someone out to check on me. She just
now
wondered who I was.
You worked on the Atlanta World.
Atlanta Daily World.
How did that come about?
I kept going to school, and they were trying to push me away from the University of Minnesota.
Well, now wait. You went to Minnesota before you went back down to Atlanta?
Yes.
Okay. Now let's get you to Minnesota for a minute. When and why did you go up there?
I came out of the Army in 1952, and I wanted to continue my education. The state of Georgia still would not allow blacks in my field at that time. Charlene Hunter had not really, Hunter Gault had not broken through there. She and Holmes were the first two who really were admitted. I tried and not allowed to enter there. I learned that Georgia would pay the transportation to another college outside of the state so long as that college was not west of the Mississippi. And so I explored and tried to find the best college I could find as far away as I could from Georgia so long as Georgia would pay. So the University of Minnesota was fine university and was right on the Mississippi. Part of the campus was west of Mississippi and part was not. And so I entered there for a graduate degree in journalism and just continued stay there so long as I could say to Georgia that I was not taking a degree that Georgia didn't offer. So rather than request the degree at the time I continued to simply study until I was being sort of pushed out by Ed Emery and some others who wanted to find jobs for me, but they were looking all over to find jobs because I wanted to report and write.
But you got your master's there.
Yes. Yes, when I say push out, I don't mean suspend me or push me away. I'd already qualified for the degree before I left.
Was there a...
I was continuing the study.
Was there a master's thesis?
There were three collateral.
Okay.
Collateral papers and three. And no, I'd done all of that, and my other colleagues were there, friends of mine, were really working toward the doctorate, and the question was, hey, are you going to do this or not? Why are you just continuing here? But to have declared for the degree at that time would have made me ineligible for the little support one gets from Georgia. They paid the difference in tuition plus transportation. I've forgotten whether it was once a year or whether they gave you.
You were there a few years before I was, but we know the same people. Of course, Emory's my guy.
George Hoggy.
George Hoggy, a wonderful man.
George was one of my classmates, especially in the international stuff. A person who eventually became head of the journalism program at the University of Wisconsin. Bud Nelson.
He's another of my friends.
Well, all of those were my classmates who around saw me hustling and struggling. We had these international things, and I was not at the start integrated, mainstreamed. I was more isolated as a student at the start, and had this class where we had to do about 10 books on something, and these guys said, you're trying to read all of them? Yes, I was really struggling. I said, no, join us. And each was reading X number of books and abstracting and sharing with one another, and I got mixed up in that with them, and things became much, much easier for me as I worked my way through.
Those guys are all gone. School. They're all...
All were marvelous people.
Yeah.
The other guy was a Texan who went to Florida.
Warren Agee?
Oh, I know.
No, Warren was up here too.
I know Warren Agee too. I knew of Warren Agee here more. I'm talking about a shorter professor who became head of started the journalism program at the University of South Florida. Can't think of his name now, but that's what these senior moments do to me.
Well, I have them too, believe me. I have them frequently. Well, that was a wonderful place to be, though, University of Minnesota.
Marvelous. So,
awfully food. Cold, though.
Oh, I will never forget the cold.
I remember parking in a parking lot down by the river and then climbing up the steps. And I got up to the top, and there came that wind. And we lived in St. Paul.
Oh.
We lived on what they called the farm campus.
I know.
And I would either take the bus... Nola was working at the university hospital, and I would take the... We and our two children were being baby. They had a babysitter there in Thatcher Hall is where we were.
Well, 52 was awfully cold. I had a car. first in my family we actually owned a car. I hit the horn. It had a metal ring there, and it just cracked off. That's how cold it was.
Oh, yeah.
I need to check the horn to see if the battery would work.
Beautiful up there, though. Yeah,
it was. Now, in summer, I loved it.
Did they help you get the job on the Atlanta World, or did you do that yourself?
I did that myself. They were They were unsuccessful in trying to get me a job, though Emory and others were checking down the Louisville Courier Journal. They thought that Louisville, if anyone would do something, they had me visit Minneapolis Trib, but in Minneapolis Trib already had their Ounce of Black, a very prominent journalist, Carl Rowan. And so I found, after graduation, as soon as I drove down to Georgia, I found that job. They were eager to hire me. That newspaper, Black News Daily, had people like Bennett and Bob Johnson, Bennett the historian.
How long were you on that paper, Sam?
2 years.
What are some of the things that you did? You were reporting.
Yes.
How did we treat you, Sam?
Oh.
Now, be honest. Now, I know you and I got along quite well.
I'll be honest. I won't be nasty. Sometimes special, and sometimes with
the attitude that I thought I was hot stuff. I thought with sometimes with a need to indicate to me that I wasn't all that. And sometimes this came from a look at other offers I had elsewhere. And so the attitude was that, okay, maybe some of my attitude was there because you're a scarce commodity, and the outsides may have been looking at you in other parts of the country, which, because of their demographics, have a need for people like you more than we do. We are ourselves a proud community. Why don't you go to those places if indeed your attitude is what we think it is? Now, those are inferences drawn from my treatment early. My one-on-one friendships were always very good with those with whom I had friends. Especially on the surface. It's only what happens or happened in conversations when I was not around which bothered me. But that didn't bother me a lot. You see, I'd lived a long time in being who I am. What really would bother me would come very much later. There was a healthy kind of respect that you know was accorded me on this faculty. There are always sociological differences. See, my upbringing makes me who I am, and sometimes things I can say, do, or even project may rankle or make someone uncomfortable. There were certain people whom I could feel pretty comfortably around socially, and invite me out, invited to your house, and a lot of times like that. And early on, I was less involved in other parts of the community, like the black community, which I have always considered myself to also have a responsibility for. I'm a marginal person. I come in, and this is where I work. Marginal persons must have their feet in more than one camp. Whereas the NAACP to me is a godsend. The NAACP is a threatening negative for many of my associates, and I think of it as the most tame and non-threatening organization anywhere. Mm-hmm. But that isn't the way it's looked at. I even see that in the current political stuff someone was equating is equating Minister Farrakhan with Duke. Minister Farrakhan has never the ability or authority to be injurious to a white person in America. He doesn't have the following for it, unless it's a crime thing in the middle of New York, whatever. And that isn't happened. There's no record of it. Yes, has he said hateful things? Well, yeah.
Al Sharpton.
Sharpton? I don't know what Sharpton has said. I don't know what Sharpton has done, except attempted to defend someone, and he attempted to defend someone. In one case, it turned out to be a bad effort, but at least by the record.
Well, he was certainly on target the other day when, and he his statements about the exoneration of those four New York cops.
Sure.
Tell me,
sure.
Did you make friends in other departments?
Yes. Yeah. Eleanor's friend Dave Griffin insists that he's my brother. I insist he is too. Families are very close. We went to church together. We've done a bunch of things together.
Do you still?
I've taken his son places. And,
do you still go to church?
Yes.
I remember you took us to a church once. Down on the
9th Street.
East side of town, yeah.
Right.
Now, did you get involved in university committees and things like that?
Yep. Yeah. I was on university council.
Wow.
At a time when we were battling to screen out black students coming into journalism. The theory was they can't spell, etc. We were screening out all students who could not spell, but the effort to screen them out was occurring just as we were beginning to recruit blacks. And so we decided that we wanted to test to determine entry. And I was on university council, and so, you know, I became chairman of that academic committee and got into some research that sort of worked against some of the interests that were rampant in the J school, but not just our J school, that were there all over the nation.
Didn't you head up a special program for minority students in the school?
A program to recruit minority students. Yes, I ran summer programs.
Okay, what I was thinking of. Yeah,
I ran summer programs to bring in urban journalists, we call them, but they were minority kids, the inner city kids. Non-traditional ones who wanted to enter journalism, I started it and made first a parallel program to the general summer camps that we had here. But my urban journalism workshops were indeed workshops. They were not camps. And so we separated them out. The money from them were coming from the newspaper fund and area newspapers. I developed those and then began to develop them at other places. Did one each summer at Temple University and one at Duquesne University and then one at Hampton University and helped others to get them started. These were just great recruiting tools.
Yeah.
And out of it, we got some very, very marvelous journalism graduates.
Well, now tell me, the National Association of Black Journalists, were you an officer in that, or?
No.
Well, now what was?
No, I could not be. I was not a black journalist. I was at the university when that was organized.
What was the Wells Award?
25 years ago.
What was the Wells Award?
The Wells Award is something I created with the help of others. It's an award is sculpted by Eldon Taft, who's a friend of mine, of Ida B. Wells. She was the black newspaper woman who...
The Kansas City... The Call?
No.
Not The Call?
Oh, no. Ida B. Wells in the end of the 16th... In the end of the 18th.
Oh, a long time ago. Oh.
She died in 1931.
Well, shows how dumb I am.
You'll be interested in her. She, as a historian, she was run out of Memphis for fighting against the lynchings of some grocery store owners there who were lynched because of their competition with a white grocer. Anyway, the Wells Award honors persons, managers who do great jobs in bringing minorities into the news media and moving them up. The first one of these was Al Newhart, and he'd done great job, and his firm did, as they were organizing USA Today. They decided that it should have a balanced inclusion of women, minorities, and that they should be mainstreamed throughout the paper. And there have been 17 or 18 of those, and each year has been marvelous representation of that.
Sam, tell me about some of the recognitions you've received. I know here, this one is quite fairly recent, 1996, from the United Minority Media Association, the Special Award for Community Service.
Uh-huh. United Minority Media Award is the Midwest area of that. Is based in Kansas City. The other award from the region recently inducted or being inducted this week into the Black Museum, Kansas African American Museum in Wichita. Along with people like Gordon Parks and some others. I got the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Association of Black Journalists. That's nearly 2 years now. Well, I got the National Volunteers Award for creating CASAP, the Cultural Enrichment Program that I developed for 5,000 students a day in Florida.
Yeah.
So some of these awards just creep up because you're getting old.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to include these news stories that I have, and if you have additional ones, I'd like you to let me have them, and I'll and if you need them back, I can copy them or something.
Okay, it's interesting. I'll give you something before you leave. The influential journalist of the century, as compiled by NABJ, includes me, as well as Ida B. Wells and some other people, Gordon Parks and some other, Carl Rowan, some outstanding people. But they have about 24 people that they include. So some of the feel-good things have been coming recently.
Now, you retired a year ago.
Yes. In June. Has it been a year? June was when I really retired.
Yeah, you were a bit over 70 when you did that, weren't you?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I retired from the classroom a year earlier. They wanted me to get out and do memoirs. And but it was at a point when
were you just getting kind of tired and worn out or what?
No.
You just figured the time would come.
It was new dean, and he wanted to know, hey, you can do memoirs. Don't let it go. Don't let it die. And as incentive, he offered me freedom from the classroom for
now,
a year, and I said that he is phased into retirement.
Yeah. What's your health? Didn't you have some recent surgery?
Yep. Yeah, they zipped my heart open. I didn't know that I'd ever been ill, but then suddenly they discovered the LAD was 98% clogged. And that's that big artery out to the outside here. And gosh, it alarmed my whole family. My dad had died a month early. And
he must have really been old.
He was 100 plus, plus 10 months.
Oh, my word.
And I had the responsibility for him, so I was keeping busy. And the reason I had them to give me a stress test was that a year earlier in running, I felt a little tightness. But they gave me the surgery, and after the surgery, I had complications. My brother, who's a surgeon, was here, and I got all kinds of special treatment. It's good to have a medic as your advocate anytime you're really ill.
Where are your children?
I have a daughter in Los Angeles and a son in Los Angeles. And I have a son from an earlier marriage in New Jersey. This is a son who, my daughter and son came out of KU for their graduate degrees. This son was at Harvard and stayed in the East. He lived in Detroit all of his younger life.
Have you and your wife been able to do much traveling? Have you ever been abroad?
Yes, and my wife has also, but when she was abroad, I was working and she wasn't with me.
Yeah.
Yes, I've been abroad. I've done so much travel in the U.S. I've touched every state in the U.S. You travel first as a journalist and then as a professor here. For 4 years, I was traveling, more or less introducing the new technology with the tech van, along with the Gannett group. And I was a journalist on that team, and we traveled to all over the place.
Do you do a computer?
Yeah. I'm behind in it.
I started on the cutting edge, as you may know, but
I don't even
have
gone.
One.
Yeah. I don't.
It's moved too fast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sam, are you? How do you feel about the university and the School of Journalism these days? Do you have any feelings about them?
I'm not sure I know where they're going now. Right now, I like the people I know who are there, and I, of course, am treated very well. The J School had, I think, some problems a few years ago. I think I know, during that period, I felt useless there. During that period, you see, when I was.
But you came, here, and you've stayed. Have you ever? Are you glad that you...
Did I stay?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad for almost everything I've done. Yes. Yes.
You don't want to go back to Waycross?
Oh, yes, I'll go back to Waycross. That's where my wife wants to go. So I'll go back there soon.
Oh, really, to live?
Yes.
Oh, really, are you going to?
Yeah, she'll be closer to her relatives. And she'll be away from something she can't navigate. Icy and snowy streets.
Uh-huh.
She has a need for single level house.
Yeah, she and I were talking about that.
So.
Yeah.
So we will go for those reasons. It's going to be very difficult because she now is so involved in the community, boards of and church, and you know, senior services, and friends.
How do you spend your time now?
Wrapping up my dad's estate. I'm still curator of the Ida B. Wells Award. I'm in J School. And trying to find the time to do what I promised to do regarding a recording of career experiences.
You ought to sit down and write your own story. We're going to have a little of it here in an outline form anyway, but seems to me you've been in some remarkable situations.
Some pretty hairy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Sam, we've been talking quite a while. I don't know. I don't want you to be exhausted.
Oh,
but
I'm fine. But
I've been.
You're fun to talk.
I've been.
You're fun to talk.
I've been looking forward to this. What we'll do after this is after the tape is listened to and transcribed. We'll get you a copy, and you'll have an opportunity to look at it. And in fact, I'd be happy to look at it with you. That way, we'll get it back to them. Some people get them and they hold them for years.
Then
this will be.
Well, give them deadlines.
Yeah. Well. Okay. We'll do that. This will be.
I want that back in.
The tape and the interviews will be placed in the university archives, and another copy of the interview will be placed in the retirees library in the Adams Alumni Center. Mm-hmm. And you'll have an opportunity to say whether or not you want to have people to have access to it. But you've got such a story here that I hope that you will say yes. And Sam, I thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you. And my condolences. I know you lost a great friend whom you introduced me to in your home years ago.
Bill Balfour?
Bill Balfour.
You know, I was thinking about that you were... You were there at a dinner one night when the Balfours were there.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he was a lovely human being.
Yes, yeah. See, out of your fellowship was a lot of understanding persons who you could connect up with very well and very easily. I found that true, too. Lee Young.
Yeah, well, there's some good guys. Did you see David Derry when he was here?
Yes.
Derry is copying a lot of old tapes for me, and he sent me a bunch. So before I came here, I stopped over at the mailbox place to send him that book about Kansas City that. Mm-hmm. That Monroe Dodd and Shirley Casper did, and I want him. And Larry Day, I hear from Larry frequently, and I know he's someone you liked. And there are a lot of good ones. Sam, thank you very much.
I promised to get something for you. I will get it. Let's see.
Okay. I'm going to.
One thing you don't have to.
I'm going to stop it now.